Chapter 8. Chaos as a Way of Life. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you. Rudyard Kipling. If. It took me about a month after my arrival at the Trump White House to have any chance to assess systematically how things worked inside. Dysfunctionality arose in many ways, often unfolding through specific policy issues, some of which I have described throughout this work. There were many more. During the last months of 2018 and early 2019, as Trump's second year in office came to an end, roughly 8 to 9 months after my arrival, several seemingly disparate issues and individuals converged to push the administration even deeper into uncharted territory. In early June 2018, for example, Kelly tried a new tactic on Trump's schedule, beginning each day in the Oval at 11 a.m. with chief of staff time, hoping to minimize the rambling lectures he delivered during his twice-weekly intelligence briefings. Of course, what most people found striking was that Trump's official day didn't start until almost lunchtime. Trump was not loafing during the morning. Instead, he spent considerable time working the phones in the residence. He talked to all manner of people, sometimes U.S. government officials. I spoke with him by phone before he arrived in the Oval nearly every day due to the press of events he needed to know about or I needed direction on. But he also spoke at length to people outside the government. It was an anomaly among contemporary presidents by any definition. By contrast, a regular day for President George H.W. Bush, described by his first chief of staff, former Governor John Sununu, started like this. The president began his formal day in the Oval Office with an 8 a.m. intelligence briefing that would include the president, the vice president, National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft, and me. That meeting, the president's daily briefing, PDB, was presented by the CIA and would take 10 to 15 minutes. Following that, always on the calendar for 8:15, was a separate half-hour for Scowcroft to bring the president and us up to date on all foreign policy issues arising from the events that occurred overnight or were expected during the course of the upcoming day. That briefing segued into a similar one at 8:45 that I would lead, addressing all other issues beyond foreign policy. Scowcroft usually stayed for that as well. My meeting was scheduled to end at 9:15. I would have thought I had died and gone to heaven to have had such an orderly approach to preparing for an upcoming day. As it was, Trump generally had only 2 intelligence briefings per week, and in most of those, he spoke at greater length than the briefers, often on matters completely unrelated to the subjects at hand. Trump's schedule was the easiest anomaly to deal with. One of the hardest was his vindictiveness, as demonstrated by the constant eruptions against John McCain, even after McCain died and could do Trump no more harm. Another example of his vindictiveness was Trump's August 15th decision to revoke former CIA Director John Brennan's security clearance. Now, Brennan was no prize, and during his tenure, the CIA became more politicized than at any other time in its history. He denied any improper behavior, but Trump was convinced Brennan was deeply implicated in abusing the FISA surveillance process to spy on his 2016 campaign, all of which was exacerbated by his constant presence in the media criticizing Trump after he took office. The press fastened on the revocation immediately after Sanders announced it during her daily noon briefing. Kelly said to me, "This Brennan thing is exploding," having spent much of the afternoon on it. "This is big." In an hour-long conversation just between the two of us, we went over what had happened. Kelly said that by mid to late July, he thought he had gotten Trump off the idea of taking away people's clearances, but Trump returned to it because his favorite media sources kept pounding away on it. Earlier in the day, Trump had wanted to revoke clearances from a longer list of names, but had settled for Sanders reading the names out at the briefing, implicitly threatening to revoke the clearances at some point in the future. I pointed out that the whole idea had started with Rand Paul. It was largely symbolic, because having a security clearance didn't mean Brennan or anyone else could just walk into the CIA and read whatever interested him. He had to have a need to know, and for anything really important, he would have to be read into the appropriate compartments. Kelly said he had had an argument with Trump about it, not the first such confrontation, but one that had obviously been harsher than previous ones. Kelly told Trump it was not presidential, which was true, and he told me it was Nixonian, also true. "Has there ever been a presidency like this?" Kelly asked me, and I assured him there had not. I thought there was a case against Brennan for politicizing the CIA, but Trump had obscured it by the blatantly political approach he took. It would only get worse if more clearances were lifted. Kelly agreed. In what by this point was already an emotional discussion for both of us, Kelly showed me a picture of his son killed in Afghanistan in 2010. Trump had referred to him earlier that day, saying to Kelly, "You suffered the worst." Since Trump was disparaging the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq at the time, he had seemingly implied that Kelly's son had died needlessly. "Trump doesn't care what happens to these guys," Kelly said. "He says it would be cool to invade Venezuela." I said relatively little during the conversation, which was mostly Kelly venting his frustrations, very few of which I disagreed with. I couldn't see how it was possible he would stay through the 2020 elections, though Trump had announced a few weeks before that he would. When I left Kelly's office, I said nothing to anyone else. Perhaps uniquely in presidential history, Trump engendered controversy over attendance at funerals, starting with Barbara Bush's in April 2018, which Trump did not attend, although four former presidents and the First Lady did, and then at John McCain's in late August. Kelly opened the weekly White House staff meeting on August 27th by saying, "I'm in a bad place today," because of ongoing disagreements with Trump over whether to fly U.S. government flags at half-mast and who would attend which services. McCain's family didn't want Trump at the services either, so the feeling was mutual. The final decision was that Pence would lead the administration's representation at both the Capitol Rotunda ceremony and the funeral service at Washington National Cathedral. The service was extremely well attended, with all the socializing that routinely accompanies even moments of passing. Among others I greeted were Bush 43 and Mrs. Bush, with Bush asking cheerily, "Still got a job, Bolton?" "For now," I answered, and we all laughed. When George H.W. Bush later died during the Buenos Aires G20, Trump declared a national day of mourning, issued a fitting presidential statement, and spoke cordially with both George W. and Jeb Bush during the mourning. He and the First Lady attended the National Cathedral service on December 5th without incident. It wasn't so hard to do after all. During the controversy over McCain's funeral, Trump tweeted that White House counsel Don McGahn was leaving at the end of the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation battle. Although McGahn had often joked to me, "We're all only one tweet away," this was a classic example of Trump's announcing something already decided without giving McGahn a chance to announce it first. I should have paid closer heed. As Kelly confirmed to me later, tensions between Trump and McGahn had become unsustainable because of McGahn's truthful testimony to and cooperation with Mueller's investigation. Even though Trump's outside attorneys had approved McGahn's role, they were all reportedly surprised by just how candid he was. In any event, the search for a replacement was immediately on. Illegal immigration, a key Trump initiative, was a shambles. White House lawyer John Eisenberg approached me in mid-May 2018 to see if I had any interest in trying to repair the collapsed White House policy process on immigration generally and at the Mexican border in particular. I had no interest entering that arena without the White House Counsel's Office and Justice fully on board. Don McGahn, who for the best of reasons focused every waking moment on judicial nominations, saw immigration policy for the swamp it was and decided to stay out of it. Justice had its own problems. Now alerted, however, I kept my eye on the issue but followed McGahn's example. I saw the problem firsthand at a cabinet meeting on immigration held on May 9th, the day after we escaped the Iran nuclear deal. Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen and Jeff Sessions were to report on what their respective departments were doing to close the Mexican border, followed by other cabinet members discussing their areas. But this was not to be a briefing where Trump listened appreciatively to his team's efforts, asked a few questions, and then patted them on their backs. Things went downhill after Sessions concluded just as Nielsen was starting. Trump asked her why we couldn't close the border, and Nielsen answered by listing all the difficulties she and her department faced. Trump interrupted, saying in front of the entire cabinet and a coterie of White House aides, his voice rising, "You're wrong. There's no way we can't close the border. Tell them the country is closed. We don't have the people, such as immigration judges, to do all these things. That's it. It's like a movie theater when it gets filled." This was already bad, but it got worse. Kelly tried to support Nielsen, who was effectively his protege, but that was a mistake. Everyone knew Nielsen had the Homeland Security job largely because of Kelly, and his intervention made it look like she couldn't defend herself, which was unfortunately proving to be true before a packed cabinet room. Kelly and Nielsen tried to turn things back towards Sessions, who appeared to say something new and different about the Department of Homeland Security's authority at the border. He was uncomfortable discussing the issue and seemingly reversed himself, basically saying the department did not have the authority he had just explained it did. Kelly fired back, "We're going to do what the Attorney General says is illegal and send them, the immigrants, back." And Sessions twisted a little more. But Trump was still after Nielsen, and she didn't have the wit to either remain silent or say, "We'll get back to you in a few days with a better answer." Finally, as if anyone could have missed the point, Trump said, "I got elected on this issue, and now I'm going to get unelected," which might not have been far from the political truth. I thought as the meeting drew to a close, it was only a matter of time before both Nielsen and Kelly resigned. And according to numerous press reports, Nielsen came very close in Kelly's office right afterward. This issue was a total mess and unnecessary, because there was much that could be done to tighten up on fraudulent, unjustifiable, and made-up claims for asylum in the United States. Things worsened further on June 20th. In a zero-tolerance policy, Trump had been prepared to separate children from their parents, or people claiming to be their parents, but who were frequently human traffickers at the border, as prior administrations, including Obama's, had done. But under political pressure, Trump reversed himself, in effect, hanging Nielsen and Sessions out to dry. After the executive order revoking zero tolerance was signed, Kelly just went home. He confirmed to me the next day his view that Trump had sold out Sessions and Nielsen, but no one had a real plan what to do next. Immigration was also jumbled in with the negotiation and ratification efforts to modify the NAFTA agreement with Canada and Mexico, foreign aid programs in Central America, and enormous turf fights among the Departments of Justice, Homeland Security, Health and Human Services, State, and others over who had what responsibility. These problems were due largely to the chaos in domestic policymaking, a problem that showed no signs of abating. Despite my efforts to stay out of the immigration stew, it kept chasing me. On October 4th, Kushner, now involved in immigration because of the spillover from the NAFTA revision effort, came to see me. He said Nielsen and her department were negotiating with Mexico's government with no State Department clearance, an obvious process foul if true. A few days later, on a Saturday, Kushner called to say Trump had suggested that he take over the immigration portfolio. He had declined because he felt Kelly was protecting Nielsen from the consequences of her own incompetence, which made the problem unfixable. "What about Bolton?" Trump asked. "Could he take it over?" Kushner said he doubted I would be interested, but Trump replied, "John's great. He gets things done. He brings me all these decisions and stuff. Really great. Can you ask him if he'd do it?" Kushner said whomever Trump selected would be in a fight with Kelly, and Trump replied, "John's not afraid of fights. He'll take him, Kelly, on." Wonderful, I thought. Great Saturday. On Monday morning, Columbus Day, I met with Stephen Miller, the White House policy lead on immigration. As we were talking, Kushner walked in and asked, "Can I join the conspiracy?" I had already emailed Pompeo, who had agreed Mexico-related immigration issues had to be brought more effectively into the NSC process, which had been frustrated for months, if not years, primarily by the Department of Homeland Security's lack of cooperation. The department just didn't want to be coordinated. My personal view was that America would benefit from far more legal, controlled immigration, whereas illegal immigration was undermining the foundational sovereignty principle that the U.S. decided who was allowed in, not the would-be immigrants. I was clear on one thing. Nielsen's effort to bring in the U.N. High Commissioner for Refugees to help us decide who to admit to the U.S. was badly flawed. We could hardly cede such basic sovereign decisions to an international body. Later in the week, after an unrelated meeting in the Oval, attended by Nielsen, Pompeo, and others, Trump was pounding away again. "We're doing the worst job on the border of any administration. I ran and won on the border. We have a national emergency," he said. And he then riffed on finding money in the Pentagon budget to build the border wall he had long promised. Trump's agitation was based in part on sensational media reporting about caravans of illegal immigrants heading through Central America toward our border, which he saw as visible proof he was not meeting his 2016 campaign pledge. Pointing to Nielsen, Trump said, "You're in charge of border security." And then, pointing to Pompeo, he said, "You're not involved." This was directly contrary to what Trump had told Kushner on Saturday, and convinced me I was happy to be as little involved in this exercise as possible. On and on it went between Trump and Nielsen. At one point, Pompeo whispered to me, "Why are we still here?" Good question. We needed to find a way out of this train wreck before Trump blamed us for the collapse of his border policy. According to Kushner, however, this latest encounter with Nielsen convinced Trump I should have control of the issue. "Kirsten is not mentally able to do it," said Kushner. 2 days later, Trump told me, "You take over the southern border. She loses every case. She's so weak." Trump wanted to declare a national emergency and had already talked to John Eisenberg about it. "You have my full authorization," said Trump. "The number one thing is the southern border. You and me. You are the fucking boss." A few hours later, with just Kelly and me in the Oval, Trump said, "I told John to take control of the border." This was getting serious. I decided to lay out for Trump the process required to get control of illegal immigration issues. If he agreed to it, I would step in. But if not, I had plenty of other work to do. I drafted a one-page plan that included giving lead international negotiation authority to the State Department, rewriting all the relevant homeland security and justice regulations, proposing sweeping new legislation on the issue, vesting policy development authority in the NSC, replacing Nielsen and Sessions, and more. I was writing for a one-person audience, but I showed drafts to Pompeo, Miller, Kushner, Eisenberg, and a few others who generally concurred. In the meantime, the caravan issue was growing steadily more neuralgic. Trump, tweeting prodigiously, asked that executive orders closing the borders be drafted, and the White House atmosphere grew increasingly febrile. On the morning of October 18th, Pompeo and I were in my office talking about the Khashoggi affair when Kelly asked both of us to come to his office. There, a mass meeting, perhaps 15 people, was in progress on the Mexico border, which Kelly summarized when Pompeo and I entered. He then asked Nielsen to describe her plan, which had the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees staffing processing facilities on the Guatemala-Mexico border. The High Commissioner's office would separate out legitimate refugees who could then enter the United States or another country from those not qualifying who would return to their countries of origin. Kelly asked Pompeo what he thought, and he responded slowly, likely knowing little about what Nielsen was saying. I jumped in, and Pompeo happily receded, to point out that the High Commissioner had no real role in this kind of immigration processing work, that its budget and personnel were already overstrained by, among other things, the Venezuelan refugee crisis, and that in any case, the U.S. shouldn't subcontract decisions on admission to the U.S. to the United Nations. Nielsen couldn't answer these points, so I continued to probe on what the refugee agency's role would be as she stumbled through her responses. Kelly asked, "Well then, what's your plan, John?" Of course, my plan was something I had no intention of discussing in a stadium-sized crowd before I had even shown it to Trump. I simply said, "Yes, I have a plan, which he, Trump, asked for, and which I will discuss with him." That caused Nielsen to do a flounce and turn her back on me, saying, "Huh," or something like that. I said, "That's exactly why I want to see the president alone." The conversation meandered around for a few minutes more, nearing 10 a.m., when I said to Kelly, "John, we should get down to the Oval to talk Saudi Arabia, just to remind everyone else that the rest of the world was still out there." Off, Pompeo, Kelly, and I went. Suffice it to say, this was not the profanity-laced shouting match the credulous media later reported. In the Oval, we were addressing the Khashoggi issue with Trump when Madeleine Westerhout came in, saying Kushner wanted to report by phone on his conversation with Mexico's foreign minister. Kelly asked loudly, "Why is Jared calling the Mexicans?" "Because I asked him to," said Trump in an equally loud voice. "How else are we going to stop the caravans?" "Kirstjen Nielsen is working on this," said Kelly, still loudly, and Trump shot back, "None of your other geniuses have been able to stop the caravans," at which point Kelly stomped out of the Oval, Trump waving his hands dismissively at Kelly's back as he left. This conversation could qualify as shouting, but there was no profanity here either. Kushner, now on the speakerphone, described his call with Luis Videgaray, while Pompeo steamed quietly, since Kushner was once again doing his job. There was some further desultory conversation, and then Pompeo and I headed back to Kelly's office. In a December conversation with Trump, as he decided on Kelly's successor, Trump acknowledged that this exchange with Kelly was the shouting match about which the press had spilled so many electrons. Several people were milling around in Kelly's outer office. He called Pompeo and me in, said, "I'm out of here," and walked out. Somewhat dazed, I suppose. Pompeo and I spoke further on Saudi Arabia, but it then hit us that Kelly meant something more than just, "You can use my office," when he walked out. I opened the door to ask where Kelly was, but no one knew. I went into the hallway, saw him speaking to someone, pulled him into the Roosevelt room, which was empty, and shut the door. This was our second emotional conversation, even more intense than the first. "I've commanded men in combat," he said, "and I've never had to put up with shit like that," referring to what had just happened in the Oval. I could see his resignation coming, so I asked, "But what is the alternative if you resign?" Kelly said, "What if we have a real crisis like 9/11 with the way he makes decisions?" I asked, "Do you think it will be better if you leave? At least wait until after the election. If you resign now, the whole election could go bad." "Maybe it would be better that way," he answered bitterly. So I said, whatever you do will be honorable. But there's nothing positive about the likes of Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders having more authority. He answered, I'm going out to Arlington, presumably to visit his son's grave, which he did at serious times. We knew this because it happened so often. I left the Roosevelt Room for Kelly's office, where Pompeo was still waiting before going out to speak to the press about Khashoggi. After his press gaggle, we spoke in my office about what to do, Kelly having left. It was grim. Mattis is always overseas, Pompeo said. The VP is in Mississippi, talking about religious freedom, and the only thing Mnuchin thinks about is covering his ass. This will just leave you and me, worrying that Kelly could go at any time. If he, Trump, wants to know who the real warriors are, just look around, meaning us. And Kelly is part of that. I agreed. Realizing how bad it all sounded, Pompeo said, this whole thing could end up being the Donald, Ivanka, and Jared show. In the midst of all this, in the early afternoon, I showed Trump my one-page immigration plan. He read through it and said he agreed with it, but added, you know, most of this I can't do until after the election, which I said I understood. He asked if he could keep the one-pager, folded it, and put it in his suit coat pocket. The ball was in his court, and from my perspective, that's where it stayed. The immigration issue rolled on, but largely without me. I had made my suggestions, which may or may not have worked had they been fully carried out, and ultimately Trump did pick bits and pieces of them. But he did it in his own way in his own time, which was his prerogative. Immigration issues stumbled along rather than forming a coherent policy. During the immigration controversy came the bombshell of the disappearance and then the assassination of Saudi Arabian journalist Jamal Khashoggi at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. Trump's handling of Khashoggi's murder was in stark contrast to his usual decision-making. On October 8th, Kushner asked how we should respond to the growing storm. My advice to the Saudis was to get the facts out immediately, whatever they were, and get it over with. Kushner agreed, and the next day we spoke with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, emphasizing how seriously this issue was already viewed. I urged the Crown Prince to find out exactly what had happened to Khashoggi and then publish the report before people's imaginations exploded. Pompeo later made the same point to him. I also proposed we send the Saudi ambassador in Washington back to Riyadh to get the facts and then come back and brief us. This was unorthodox, but the ambassador was the Crown Prince's younger brother and could reinforce firsthand what the temperature was in Washington. Unlike with so many other issues, however, Trump had essentially already decided on his response, saying in a pre-taped interview for 60 Minutes for the coming weekend that he wasn't going to cut off arms sales to the kingdom. On Saturday, when we welcomed Pastor Brunson to the White House after his release from Turkey, I suggested Pompeo go to Saudi Arabia rather than sending a lower-ranking official, which he and Trump liked. No one could say we weren't taking this seriously. Trump raised the idea with King Salman on October 15th, and the king said he would welcome Pompeo's visit. Trump was feeling pressure from the U.S. media, but the pressure was unexpectedly moving him towards stronger public support for the kingdom, not less. Pompeo's whirlwind trip bought some time, during which the Saudis would have more opportunity to get the facts out, but Trump was not waiting. The Saudis subsequently published their version of the events and fired several senior officials. The Saudi report didn't satisfy most analysts, but it reflected a narrative that obviously wasn't going to change. During this period, through tweets and statements, Trump supported the emerging Saudi version and never wavered from both the U.S.-Saudi alliance generally or the massive arms sales already negotiated with the kingdom. With the media in a foaming-at-the-mouth frenzy, Trump decided to issue an unequivocal statement of support for Mohammed bin Salman, which he essentially dictated to Pompeo. The text was utterly unqualified and thus risked harming Trump himself if the facts changed. It was not all that difficult to make a few editorial changes to build in protection, but Pompeo would not accept any changes or even hold the draft a day for further review. Pompeo said, "He asked for it, and I'm sending it in." A characteristic, "Yes, sir, roger that," answer. The next day, November 20th, my birthday, Trump wanted to call bin Salman to tell him the statement was coming out, saying, "We're doing him a hell of a favor," namely stating that, whether he did it or not, we're standing with Saudi Arabia. We debated whether Trump himself would read the statement from the White House podium or whether we would just release the text. "This will divert from Ivanka," Trump said. "If I read the statement in person, this will take over the Ivanka thing." The Ivanka thing was a flood of stories about Ivanka's extensive use of her personal email for government business, which the White House was trying to explain was actually quite different from Hillary Clinton's extensive use of her personal email for government business. "God damn it, why didn't she change her phone?" Trump complained. "What a mess we have because of that phone." Then he turned to Pompeo, settling on his calling the Crown Prince, and said, "Tell him it's unbelievable. What a great thing I'm doing. Then get his opinion, and we'll decide what to do." We decided to issue a statement and have Pompeo answer questions, but there was considerable debate over whether the text should be released before or after the annual ceremony pardoning the Thanksgiving turkey. Pun not intended. "Sorry, Crown Prince, but we have our priorities." I met with Turkey's foreign minister that same day. Another coincidence. Pompeo and Trump both ultimately took questions, which Trump had wanted to do anyway. It was an all-Trump show, obvious to everyone except Rand Paul, who tweeted that he thought I had written the statement. In hard-nosed geopolitical terms, Trump's was the only sensible approach. No one excused Khashoggi's murder, and few doubted it was a serious mistake. Whether or not you liked Saudi Arabia, the monarchy, Mohammed bin Salman, or Khashoggi, we had significant U.S. national interests at stake. Withdrawing support would immediately trigger countervailing efforts by our adversaries in the region to exploit the situation to our detriment. Putin had earlier put it to me most bluntly in Moscow, see Chapter 6, on October 23rd, saying Russia could sell arms to the Saudis if we didn't. Trump wasn't necessarily deciding on the basis of geostrategic reality, but on the U.S. jobs generated by the arms sales, and he ended up in more or less the right place. This approach was exactly Jean Kirkpatrick's conclusion in her iconic 1979 essay, Dictatorships and Double Standards. Liberal idealism need not be identical with masochism and need not be incompatible with the defense of freedom and the national interest. Personnel management issues, also critical to policy development, portended a series of dramatic changes following the November 2018 congressional elections. Jim Mattis and his staff, for example, had a masterful command of press relations, carefully cultivating his reputation as a warrior scholar. One story I was sure the media hadn't heard from Mattis was one told by Trump on May 25th as Marine One flew back to the White House from Annapolis after Trump's graduation speech to the Naval Academy. He said Mattis had told him, regarding Trump's appearing in a scheduled presidential debate with Clinton just days after the Access Hollywood story broke in the press, that it was the bravest thing he had ever seen anyone do. Coming from a career military man, that was indeed something. Of course, Trump could have been making it up, but if not, it showed Mattis knew how to flatter with the best of them. There was no doubt Mattis was in troubled waters by the summer of 2018, and he grew steadily weaker as the year unfolded. At about 9:45 p.m. on Sunday, September 16th, Trump called me to ask if I had seen a prominently displayed New York Times article about Mattis and read it carefully, which I said I had. I don't like it, said Trump. Mattis is always doing this kind of thing. I said I thought the article was very unfair to Deputy National Security Advisor Mira Ricardel, brought on by the enmity she had earned from Mattis in her early days at the White House, where she resisted Mattis's efforts to hire Democrats with views incompatible with Trump's. She stopped Rex from bringing in some of his people too, right? Trump asked, which was also true. What do you think of Mattis? Trump asked, in line with his management style, which almost no one believed was conducive to building trust and confidence among his subordinates. But he did it all the time. And only a fool would not assume that if he asked me questions about Mattis, he was surely asking others about me. I gave a partial answer which was both true and important. I said Mattis was good at not doing what he didn't want to do, and that he had a high opinion of his own opinion. With that, Trump was off, explaining that he didn't trust Mattis, and how tired he was of constant press stories about Mattis's outwitting Trump. I didn't say it to Trump, but this was the biggest self-inflicted wound by the axis of adults. They thought themselves so smart they could tell the world how smart they were, and Trump wouldn't figure it out. They were not as smart as they thought. Kelly came to my office late the next morning to talk about the article, saying Mattis is just in survival mode now, and that he was pointing the finger for the leaks at Ricardel, which showed amazing chutzpah. I explained Judge Larry Silberman's theory about assessing leaks, namely asking cui bono, which means who stands to gain, and which, in this case, pointed squarely to Mattis and his associates being the leakers. Kelly had served under Mattis in the Marines, as had Joe Dunford, a remarkable alignment the press never seemed to notice, and that a spy novelist could not have convinced a publisher was plausible. Trump, Kelly, and I discussed the article again later in the day, and Trump asked, "Mattis didn't like canceling the Iran deal, did he?" Which was an understatement. Shortly thereafter, the speculation on Mattis's replacement picked up again in earnest. I wondered if the leaks started in the Oval Office. 1 week later, however, when I was in New York for the annual opening festivities of the UN General Assembly, Kelly called me to say the First Lady wanted Ricardel fired because her staff complained she had been uncooperative in preparing for FLOTUS's upcoming trip to Africa. I found this stunning, and Kelly said it was not clear how it got to this level. He then characterized the First Lady's staff as a bunch of catty, gossipy sorority types. No one said anything further to me, and I thought it had died away. Kelly was still in Washington because of this Rosenstein thing, meaning the stories about whether Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein had ever proposed invoking the 25th Amendment against Trump, or that he wear a wire into the Oval to gather evidence to that end. This was also a first in presidential management history. Being in New York reminded me why UN ambassadors should not have cabinet rank, the traditional Republican approach. Or, if they were going to have that rank, they needed to be told by the president that there was nonetheless only one Secretary of State. Haley had never gotten that reminder, and from everything I heard, including directly from Trump, she and Tillerson cordially detested one another. Well, maybe not cordially. Early evidence of the Haley problem occurred in her mishandling of the Russia sanctions question in the immediate aftermath of the April U.S. attack on Syria. It emerged again in June regarding U.S. withdrawal from the UN's misbegotten Human Rights Council. Trump agreed to leave it, which all of his advisors recommended, confirming it in an Oval Office meeting with Pompeo, Haley, and me. Trump then asked Haley, "How's it going?" And she responded by talking about the trade negotiations with China, which formed no part of her responsibilities. After a lengthy trade riff by Trump with all his favorite lines, "The EU is just like China, only smaller," Haley asked him about a trip she wanted to take to India to visit the Dalai Lama. The purpose of this trip was unclear, other than getting a photo op with the Dalai Lama, always good for an aspiring Paul. But the minefield she strayed into by raising the China trade issue showed a political tin ear. Once Trump wondered how China would view Haley's seeing the Dalai Lama, the trip was essentially dead. This episode confirmed to Pompeo how far out of line Trump had allowed Haley to drift and why it had to stop. In any case, on June 19th, we withdrew from the Human Rights Council. Replacing departing senior administration officials could also be arduous, especially as the halfway mark in Trump's term neared. Choosing Haley's successor was one such marathon. After conferring alone with Trump, Ivanka, and Kushner on a purely personal matter, Haley told Kelly, but not Pompeo or me, on October 9th that she was resigning. Although that resignation came with a long recessional extending until its effective date on December 31st. Few doubted the 2024 race for the Republican presidential nomination had now begun. In a jaw-dropping statement, sitting next to the president in the Oval, Haley ruled out a 2020 run, just so she could remind everyone she was available. "No, I'm not running for 2020. I can promise you what I'll be doing is campaigning for this one." Many thought she was instead running to replace Pence as Trump's 2020 running mate, supported by Kushner and Ivanka, which was not idle speculation. One Trump prerequisite for Haley's successor was that it be a female. Early favorite Dina Powell had been at the NSC and, preferred by the family, initially appeared to be a shoo-in. Enormous opposition developed, however, and the search was quickly on for other candidates. Pompeo and I agreed from the outset that the UN ambassador should not have cabinet rank, but we first had to persuade Trump. He said of Powell that cabinet status will help her out, which left me speechless. If someone needed that kind of help, they should have been looking for other work. In addition to the status issue, Pompeo and I discussed over several weeks possible alternatives, conferring with several of them to see if they were interested. When the sorting was done, we both concluded that Ambassador to Canada Kelly Craft was the most logical choice. In addition to being qualified, Craft was already in the administration, had been fully vetted and granted appropriate security clearances, and was therefore ready quickly to assume new duties. In the meantime, the White House lapsed into full conspiracy mode, as everyone had an opinion about who should succeed Haley. I never went through a time where more people told me not to trust other people on an issue. Perhaps they were all right. The internal politics were Byzantine, much of it played out in the media. Candidates rose and fell, entered and withdrew, and then entered again, came close, or were actually picked, only to find some disqualifying factor took them out of the running and us back to the beginning. Even when Pompeo and I thought we had Trump decided on one candidate, we were often wrong. As Pompeo said at the November G20 meeting, "You can't leave him alone for a minute." It was like being in a hall of mirrors. As the weeks passed, I wondered if we would have a nominee in time to get her confirmed before Haley's 3-month-long curtain call ended on New Year's Eve. Indeed, we didn't. Not until February 22nd in the Oval Office, when Trump called me down in mid-afternoon, did Trump and Kelly Craft shake hands on the nomination. I was delighted, as was Pompeo, but dismayed that nearly 5 months had disappeared on something that could have been resolved in just days after Haley's announcement. Trump said to Kraft, "It's the best job in government next to mine," which I thought wasn't far from wrong. We were done, at least with the executive branch deliberations. Almost 5 months in the making. As Mattis's troubles continued to rise, speculation turned to whether Kelly might also have finally had enough. Pompeo said, "If Mattis goes, Kelly goes too," which had a logic to it. This was now beyond personal dysfunction, but meant a major change in White House direction. Nielsen's unending problems with Trump also seemed to indicate her early departure, another incentive for Kelly to leave, but she hung on. Indeed, Nielsen lasted until April 2019, probably long after she should have left voluntarily for her own well-being. Kelly and Kushner also had not gotten along well since the controversy over Kushner's security clearance. Kelly also had his troubles, not unlike those I experienced, with Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, a Trump confidant. In July 2018, for example, Mnuchin fussed endlessly about a press release he wanted to issue on new sanctions against a Russian bank that had facilitated North Korea's international financial transactions. Trump agreed the sanctions should proceed, but he didn't want a press release to avoid potential negative reactions from Moscow and Pyongyang. Mnuchin feared Congress would grill him for covering up for Russia if he didn't issue something. I thought he was overwrought, and a few days later, Trump agreed to a release. Exasperated, Kelly told me Mnuchin cared more than anything not to be exposed to any risk, notwithstanding his inordinate desire to attend Oval Office meetings and travel the world. A few days before, Kelly and I had spoken about Mnuchin's efforts to get into meetings where he had no role, including calling Trump to get himself invited. Kelly said he was sure Mnuchin spent far less than half his time at his desk at Treasury, so eager was he to go to White House meetings or on presidential trips. "They hardly recognize him in his building," said Kelly disdainfully. In the meantime, Mattis's long-standing efforts to fire Ricardel, combined with the clandestine efforts of the First Lady's staff, finally had their effect. I was in Paris for meetings in advance of Trump's arrival to attend the November 11th World War I Armistice Day centenary. On the evening of November 9th, as I was walking to dinner with my British, French, and German counterparts, Kelly called me from Air Force One, which was nearing arrival in Paris. We were on non-secure phones, so we didn't talk fully until closer to midnight, when Kelly said the First Lady's office was still trying to get Ricardel fired. "I have nothing to do with this," said Kelly. On Saturday, I went to the U.S. ambassador's residence where Trump was staying to brief him before his bilateral with Macron. The weather was bad, and Kelly and I spoke about whether to travel as planned to the Chateau Thierry Belleau Wood monuments and nearby American cemeteries where many U.S. World War I dead were buried. Marine One's crew was saying that bad visibility could make it imprudent to chopper to the cemetery. The ceiling was not too low for Marines to fly in combat, but flying POTUS was obviously something very different. If a motorcade were necessary, it could take between 90 and 120 minutes each way, along roads that were not exactly freeways, posing an unacceptable risk that we could not get the president out of France quickly enough in case of an emergency. It was a straightforward decision to cancel the visit, but very hard for a Marine like Kelly to recommend, having originally been the one to suggest Belleau Wood, an iconic battle in Marine Corps history. Trump agreed, and it was decided that others would drive to the cemetery instead. As the meeting broke up and we prepared to leave for the Élysée Palace to see Macron, Trump pulled Kelly and me aside and said, "Find another spot for Mira. Melania's people are on the warpath." Kelly and I assumed we were to find an equivalent position elsewhere in government in a calmer setting in Washington. The press turned canceling the cemetery visit into a story that Trump was afraid of the rain and took glee in pointing out that other world leaders traveled around during the day. Of course, none of them were the President of the United States, but the press didn't understand that rules for U.S. presidents are different from the rules for 190 other leaders who don't command the world's greatest military forces. Trump blamed Kelly unfairly, marking a possibly decisive moment in ending his White House tenure. Trump was displeased throughout the trip, he's in a royal funk, as Sanders put it, because of the disappointing election results, and nothing made things better. The rest of the Paris visit was similar. Macron opened their bilateral meeting by talking about a European army, as he had been doing publicly earlier, which a large number of other Americans were fully prepared to let the ungrateful Europeans have without us. Macron all but insulted Trump in his November 11th speech at the Arc de Triomphe, saying, "Patriotism is the exact opposite of nationalism. Nationalism is a betrayal of patriotism by saying, our interest first. Who cares about the others?" Trump said he didn't hear Macron's rebuff because his earpiece cut off at the critical point. After Paris, I flew on to the United Arab Emirates and then Singapore to help support the Vice President's trip to the annual Association of Southeast Asian Nations Summit. At 2:20 a.m. on November 14th, Ricardel called to say there was a Wall Street Journal story, obviously leaked from an unfriendly source, that she was about to be fired. The story was also full of speculation on Kelly and Nielsen's being fired, so I immediately called to reach Trump, Singapore being 13 hours ahead of Washington, and others to find out what was happening. In the interim, an incredible tweet went out from the Office of the First Lady that Ricardel no longer deserved to work at the White House. Talk about unprecedented. I was still digesting this when Trump called me back at about 5:30 a.m. He asked, "What is this thing from the First Lady?" and called de Westerhout to bring him the tweet, which he read for the first time. "Holy fuck," he shouted. "How could they put that out without showing it to me?" Good question, I thought. "Let me work on this," Trump concluded. Trump later called Ricardel and the FLOTUS staffers into the Oval, where they presented their versions of the FLOTUS Africa trip Ricardel had tried to keep from going off the rails due to the ignorance and insensitivity of the First Lady's staffers. Ricardel had never actually met the First Lady. All the criticism was from her staff. Trump was justifiably irritated by the tweet from the Office of the First Lady, which the staffers denied they were responsible for. "That statement is crap," said Trump correctly. I spoke to Pence about Ricardel when the two of us had a private lunch. "She's great," he said, and promised to be totally supportive. Kelly called later in the day to say Trump had instructed him, after the Oval meeting, "Find a place for her to land. We should keep her in the government," and that he'd said, "She's not a bad person," despite what the FLOTUS staffers had alleged. Kelly went on to say, Paris was a complete disaster, and that Trump had complained incessantly on Air Force One flying back to Washington and even thereafter. He kept rehashing what had gone wrong, along with demanding that Mattis and Nielsen be fired, largely due to the Mexican border issue. Kelly said he had gotten Trump off a number of ledges, but was not at all sure what would come next. I asked him to keep me posted, and he said simply, "Okay, pal," which told me he didn't have a lot of friends left at the White House. Trump issued a statement the next day that Ricardel would be transitioning to a new job in the administration, although we didn't have it nailed down yet. Unfortunately, the atmosphere had been so poisoned by the FLOTUS staff that Ricardel decided on her own simply to leave government entirely and rejoin the private sector. The whole thing was appalling to me and grossly unfair to Ricardel. I did my own evaluation of the NSC after almost 9 months. Substantively, we had met a do-no-harm standard, entering no new bad deals and exiting several inherited from days gone by. For example, the Iran nuclear deal, the INF Treaty. But I could sense turmoil was coming on other fronts. As the November election approached, the rumor mills were going full speed, especially given the disappointing results, and after Armistice Day, rumors circulated constantly about who might succeed Kelly. One persistent theory was that Trump would select Nick Ayers, Pence's chief of staff. It was unusual, to say the least, to move from working for the VP to working for the president, but Jim Baker had gone from being George H.W. Bush's campaign manager in 1980 to being Reagan's White House chief of staff. Ayer's political skills made him a logical choice, if Kelly decided to leave, for a president looking toward a re-election campaign, but the real question was whether Ayers wanted it. He sought in advance to define the terms of the role, and Trump seemed amenable to doing so, but repeatedly reneged on key points or dismissed the entire idea of a job description as unworkable. Although Ayers was tempted by the job, the experiences of the past 2 years had convinced him that, without a piece of paper to fall back on in times of crisis, the risk was not worth taking. Of course, it was an open question whether the piece of paper would have ever been worth anything, but that question would never be answered. While this personnel pot simmered, the Mattis pot came to a boil. Nonetheless, I still fully expected Ayers would be named to succeed Kelly, likely on Monday, December 10, 2018. Kelly told me that morning at 6:30 a.m., one of our last early conversations, that after 2 days working directly for Trump as an experiment, Ayers had decided it would simply not work. Kelly was also convinced Trump planned to swap Haley for Pence as the 2020 VP nominee, which would have put Ayers in an impossible position. In any case, we were back at square one, and the whole world knew it. The only good news was that on December 10th, Pat Cipollone started as White House counsel, not a minute too soon. Mattis's departure soon became highly public. Many candidates, inside and outside, vied for the chief of staff role, but Trump tweeted on December 14th that Mick Mulvaney, director of the Office of Management and Budget, would be acting chief of staff once Kelly left. Kushner came by that afternoon to say he was delighted at the decision and that the acting part of the title was just a charade. As I pieced things together later, there were no real negotiations between Trump and Mulvaney over the terms of the job, so the decision struck me as somewhat impulsive. Pompeo thought Mulvaney would do essentially whatever Ivanka and Kushner wanted him to do, which worried both of us philosophically. The handover from Kelly to Mulvaney was effective January 2nd. In an October 2019 interview in the midst of the Ukraine impeachment crisis, Kelly said he had told Trump, "Whatever you do, and we were still in the process of trying to find someone to take my place, I said, whatever you do, don't hire a yes man, someone who won't tell you the truth. Don't do that, because if you do, I believe you will be impeached." Trump flatly denied Kelly had made such a statement. "John Kelly never said that. He never said anything like that. If he would have said that, I would have thrown him out of the office. He just wants to come back into the action like everybody else does." And Stephanie Grisham, previously one of the First Lady's Furies, now White House Press Secretary, pronounced ex cathedra, "I worked with John Kelly, and he was totally unequipped to handle the genius of our great president." These quotes speak volumes about the people who uttered them. With Kelly's departure and Mulvaney's appointment, all effective efforts at managing the executive office of the president ceased. Both domestic policy strategy and political strategy, never strong suits, all but disappeared. Personnel decisions deteriorated further, and the general chaos spread. The crisis over Ukraine followed. There was a lot of evidence that Kelly's hypothesis was entirely correct.